This is True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup. This season of True Tales of Luxury is proudly sponsored by Visa. Visa, everywhere you want to be.
I personally need to feel this state of just wasting time in order to feel renewed and to get ideas and to daydream and to feel alive. I think it's just, yeah, wasting time. It just feels, to me, that's a kind of a great luxury.
In this series of podcasts, I'm talking to people at the forefront of the creative industries about their life and work and their relationship to luxury. My guest today is an unusual, possibly unique combination of poet, director, actor, and model. Greta Bellacina appeared in Harry Potter when she was just 13 and was shortlisted for the Young Poet Laureate for her debut collection of poems when she was still a student. She's been called a wunderkind who wants to revolutionise poetry and has almost certainly played a part in the current resurgence of interest in the art form. Greta, welcome to Harrods. I think you are the first ever poet in residence at Harrods. Now, I mean, I know that you've worked with brands before, and we'll talk a little bit more about that marriage of poetry and branding later, which might seem to some an incongruous one. But a poet in residence at Harrods, I mean, do you know where you want to sit?
No, I feel very honoured. I used to come to Harrods as a young girl and walk around and just be in total awe of everything. It always just felt so, I don't know, wondrous that, you know, I feel very honoured to be the first poet in residence. Hopefully there'll be more.
And are you going to do like Alain de Botton did when he was a poet in residence at Heathrow, where he sat in the middle of, I think it was Terminal 4, which had just been built, and tried to write a book?
Well, I mean, I probably won't be in the middle. I probably go and hide somewhere, like the toilets or something. I don't know.
I don't know. It's quite good here in the personal shopping penthouse.
No, it is. God, I've never been back here before. So everything's so padded and luxurious. It's quite good for children, actually. There's no sharp edges.
I'm sure that's exactly what they were thinking when they padded the room.
There's lots of excited shoppers.
But are you expected to find inspiration in Harrods? I mean, what would be a typical poem that might suit the sort of job description?
Well, the first one I've written for Harrods is one about sort of like the power of the imagination. Because I think so much when you kind of go into, I don't know, big shops, and especially just as an aspirational shopper, if you necessarily can't afford something, you know, just that idea of dreaming about it and just seeing how, you know, all this stuff comes from so many different places and it lands here in one place that, yeah, so that's the first poem. I've got it here in case you want me to start with it.
Very
start
much.
Start with poetry.
Let's hear it. Why not?
Okay, it's called Pale Gold Wonders. The flowers grew much quicker than expected. They pulled their faces to the world, shivering thoughts of love and oxygen. Pale gold wonders, tiny prisms of anniversary songs made like dream shadows by the private magic of rain, dancing to the renewal of land, gentle reminders of hope and kindness to come.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
And you also talked quite beautifully about Harrods, I thought, and the idea of all these things coming from all over the world. And so is that how you marry art and commerce, by finding your own path through something that doesn't necessarily lend itself?
Yeah, I think it's about finding art and sort of words and poetry in unexpected places. I think I often find when working with, you know, brands or whatever, it's when you least expect it, it seems to bring you people to it. And actually, I think poetry and all good art, it should just be for the people. It shouldn't be reserved in kind of dusty old books or in art galleries. I think there's something quite novel about just seeing it in a department store, whether or not you sort of instantly like it or not. I don't know, just the fact that it's there is quite nice.
And how do you make sure, though, because I mean, obviously there's going to be a lot of sort of old school poets out there who would think that it's absolutely an anathema to be, you know, poet in residence anywhere, really, that's a commercial deal. How do you make it so that you don't become subsumed by the branding and the environment, and that people can still believe that what you're writing is true, emotionally true, despite the fact that you're coming at it from a pretty pragmatic commercial angle.
Well, I think it's just about being as kind of uncompromising with the work. I know it sounds sort of easier said than done, but ultimately you have the final decision. I think, especially with this poem, I don't know, I think that I said the word womb in one of them, and I think someone said, oh, this sounds a bit of negative connotation. And I said, well, no, I completely disagree. Because
yeah, I really hope womb isn't a negative connotation.
But the metaphor of the poem was obviously a very positive thing. I mean, ultimately, like any writer or whoever, I think you don't write it for an audience, really. It has to be for yourself, and then you hope that other people enjoy it. I think if I was a young girl and being an aspiring poet and just to know that there was someone there doing something, I think, I don't know, I'd find it inspiring.
I thought I just had a child in the background. I know. Maybe you were right about the sharp edges. You mentioned, you know, sort of being true to the poetry and so on, and I wonder if there is also something about this new generation of poets. Mm-hmm. You know, I talked in the introduction about a resurgence in interest, and there are incredible sort of poetry performances going on every night in the capital city. And I'm sure that that's reflected around the country as well. Do you think it's because they're approaching poetry in a different way that there is this resurgence of interest, that it is precisely because they're not ploughing the same old furrow of tortured poet, you know, living on a crust and actually stepping out into the world, that it's resonating more with younger readers?
I think that there's always been like a communities of poets, but I think the internet has been a huge kind of aid, in the sense that I don't think when somebody, the person who invented Instagram, thought it would be a place of poetry, I think they'd probably quite surprised that poetry sort of lived there. But actually, the most shared thing on Instagram apparently is poetry, it's words. And I think that's probably because we're so consumed by curated images the whole time that actually it's quite refreshing to kind of stumble across something which is, you know, unique and gives you time to sort of break free from those kind of same pictures which you've seen over and over again.
My perfect Tuscan holiday.
Yeah, exactly. I think the internet has definitely helped, and it's also made it a more
democratic,
audience. Because you don't have to wait for Faber and Faber to publish your first collection. You know, you can get it out there and somebody might like it, 100 people might like it, 1 million people might like it, who knows?
You are still very young, but you were very young when you started writing poetry. So I wondered if you could tell me a little bit about your childhood in Camden,
yes.
I believe.
Yes.
In quite a creative household.
Yeah.
So it probably wasn't that incongruous, you sitting writing your poems in your garret.
There was no garret, I assure you. I'm sorry. It was mainly in the library or just kind of...
Library or library in your house.
And a local library. And do you know what? I love writing in chain cafes. I just find there's nothing better than knowing that you buy your £2 coffee and that nobody will come and interrupt you. You know, there's just people moving around you, but they don't kind of talk to you. But anyway, that was an aside.
No, I'd like to know, but also about what the presence of other people lends to the experience of writing, because really you could go and sit in the corner of your kitchen and do that.
Yeah.
So why do you want to be in a public place?
I just feel that I have to leave the house every day. I kind of have to know that there's a world outside, there's people rushing around. I think maybe because writing is so solitary, that there's just the essence of other people, maybe you just feel like you're entering this greater consciousness that the city just has in a way, organically. Yeah, and I'm also from a big family. I'm one of 5 siblings, and there was always just a lot of chaos and dramas all the time.
So no need for telly?
No need for telly. To be honest, we barely watched any TV. My brother used to like lock himself in the one room with the TV, and we were kind of left to sort of live outside. I don't know.
What was he watching?
He was a TV addict. Sorry, Louis. No, he was just obsessed with kind of like war films. War films, anything to do with battles and I don't know.
No wonder you weren't battering the door down. But you were then otherwise occupied scribbling on pieces of paper?
Yeah.
Sonnets and odes?
I think at the beginning it was pretty embarrassing. It was a bit of everything. I think...
Brokenhearted?
Yeah, it kind of... I came to poetry reading it and loving it and loving words and loving the musicality of words. And I'd think like poetry is a phonetic language. It should be spoken. So I just have always been obsessed with hearing language and without maybe necessarily understanding everything I was reading or everything I was writing myself. And my father's a musician, and I think maybe by osmosis, it's just loving language kind of probably came out of that. I remember reading T.S. Eliot, The Wasteland, really young and not knowing exactly what it was about, but thinking the language was really epic. And I still feel that way. I think when reading novels, I mean, I love reading novels and I find it so therapeutic, but I still find the language quite boring. And I think I was kind of drawn to the epicness of being able to say something profound, but in a few words.
But you went to RADA.
I know.
Which is the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts.
Yeah, it's true. And I think whilst I was there, I went there when I was 18, I only went for a year, and then I went to King's College. And
so did you briefly want to be an actress?
Well, I started, I'd always done acting quite young, I guess. So I went to Sylvia Young Theatre School as a child on the weekend and did sort of auditions. They were my agent when I was about 10. And I did lots of theatre and performed. Then did Harry Potter when I was 13 for a year, and I played Stephanie Turnip, who was just a Slytherin student. I had a few lines. I guess I always felt most comfortable performing, and I guess the sort of marrying of just writing kind of was just another version of that, really.
But it feels like you decided that you didn't particularly want to be an actor,
yeah.
You know, because to be a successful actor, I think you pretty much have to be all consumed by it.
I found it frustrating reading some of the scripts, and I was never really that interested in doing theatre acting. And I'd always been slowly making my own sort of writing my own scripts, and it felt like I'd been doing it for years and nothing really excited me. And I had lots of friends who were successful actors, and you just don't have a say in what you do. I'm kind of a control freak, and I have to know what I'm doing the next day. I was speaking to someone about it actually a few days ago, and just super successful actor, and just you'd think that they'd be having the phone ringing off the hook, and it's a frustrating place to be. And I think
demoralizing.
It's so demoralizing, and I think it hardens your soul if you're naturally somebody who loves creating. So I kind of was lucky enough to meet a few directors and a few writers who were open to collaborating, and I kind of started experimenting, making kind of short films, and I performed in a few indie films, and it was a really good learning process, just because everything you have to do yourself. So even if you're performing in it, you probably then will have to be the person to read be the script reader. I don't know, you kind of end up doing everything.
You've just ended up in that situation, really, haven't you? Because you've just made a film called Hurt by Paradise, which I think you co-wrote and
yes.
directed.
Yes, and also starred.
But of course.
It was a monster of a project. I didn't realise. I'd made my first feature film I made was a documentary called The Safe House, A Decline of Ideas, and it was actually about the decline of the British public library system. And making a feature documentary is so different to making a feature fiction film, which I've learned.
But on the hoof, as it were.
It was just, I feel like I've done a degree in film. I think the next one I make will be the film.
It's also sort of slightly autobiographical, the story?
Semi, in the sense that the main character, Celeste, is a struggling poet who is a single mother, and which I'm not, but... And she's desperately trying to get her first book published. And the opening scene is her going to this quite swanky literary agent to try and persuade them that her book is worth publishing. And Nicholas Rowe, who plays the quite smarmy literary agent, in a kind of high-handed way, but very charmingly, sort of says, sorry, but no, this is not going to sell. And... poetry should be a hobby. And I guess I have...
Did anyone ever say that to you?
Well, not in those words, but there have been a few awkward conversations, let's put it that way. Because, I don't know, I guess when you tell somebody you're a poet, people do often look at you quite confused. And I think it's definitely been a big challenge over the last 10 years, just trying to tell people that it should be published and it deserves to be out there, and you can't wait until you're dead because you need to live and you've got to pay rent. And yeah, so there's definitely been moments of despair and, I don't know, your dreams feeling like they've been shattered.
Is that what propelled you and your husband Robert into starting your own printing press?
Yeah, so we started the New River Press I think 3 years ago. I'm more of a traditional poet in the sense I go and perform it and do poetry readings, whereas Robert is an artist, but he makes art from poetic statements. And but both of us from teenagers, we've just always been trying to fight the same battle of getting poetry out there and trying to find a way to survive. And we started it because we just knew so many amazing young poets who are incredibly talented, but just couldn't afford to keep doing it and couldn't find a route and couldn't get someone to publish their work. And we also knew a lot of poets who were in their 60s and 70s who wrote quite out there political stuff, such as Heathcote Williams, who we published his last collection. And people were just afraid to publish it because I guess it wasn't PC enough, I don't know, but... we were trying to figure out how we were going to do it. So we decided one night that we would just run it like Factory Records and give the writers 50%.
Joy Division label, yeah.
Exactly, and give the writers 50% of the profit. Because usually when you publish a book, as I'm sure you know, it's especially a poetry book, you kind of get a very, very small advance. And then you get... I guess like 5% or 10% of your royalties, which is nothing.
And the chance to perform free at literary festivals.
Totally. And it's just, it's so impossible. You end up having, it ends up costing you to publish the book in the end.
But how can you sustain that as a business model? Because if it's sustainable, everyone should be doing it.
Well, that's, we'll find out. Yeah, it's been an experiment, but it's been great to see because, you know, we've got book deals in places we wouldn't necessarily see poetry, like Urban Outfitters. It goes back to this thing again of putting it out there into spaces which make it accessible for people to buy.
So when
teenagers,
you say, what is it in Urban Outfitters? Is it a book of collected poems, or how do you sell it? Like, how do you make? I mean, I presume you work hard at making it look appealing on the shelves,
yeah,
with all those other little things that you can buy for people there.
Yeah, no, totally. We have one book called Smear, which is a feminist collection of all ages poets. Some of them established, some of them first time poets. So yeah, there's collections like that, which I think if you were a young girl or boy walking around their shopping centre in Hull and you came across that and you know, you might like poetry and you might think you want to do it, but you might be discouraged because you've never seen a collection of poetry like it. You might find it inspiring. And going back to what we were saying about it, there being a rise of poetry with young people, I think we need to find places to have kind of candid writing, which is just talking about honest things, which isn't censored. I think poetry is that last space of just uncensored language.
People talk a lot about the absence of interest in younger people with the written word, with books, with anything other than social media and, you know, TV, I suppose, and Marvel movies. and it does paint a sort of pretty bleak picture. But then you sit and talk to someone like you who's working with people who are even younger than yourself. Mm. You're in your late 20s, yes. I think. And that seems to be not necessarily the picture that you paint a portrait of, perhaps a slightly more questing, hungry generation than the one that sort of broad brushstrokes is trying to encapsulate.
No, totally. I think every year we publish a collection of a yearbook, and I think we have about 200 poems in there. We do an open call on Instagram, and we're so astonished by how many young teenage writers there are.
You mentioned that you'd made a documentary before you made Hurt by Paradise, your feature film, and it was about the libraries. I wondered what you had unearthed in your pursuit of exploring that subject in terms of the importance of libraries to young people growing up. I mean, I was particularly struck by, I think, one of the 17-year-olds that you encountered who you know, really didn't have anywhere else to go and study and was very worried about their local library closing down.
Yeah. I mean, I was so horrified because I only knew, I have a personal love for libraries because, you know, I went to my local state school and I had lots of siblings. So I was always trying to find space to write and space to dream and space to think of ideas. And I always went to the library, and I knew a lot of students who used that space. But in the press, there'd lots of articles about them being unused spaces. But it wasn't until I kind of went around England and Britain, seeing these places just being turned into local gyms and luxury apartments, and seeing how communities just changed. We went to the first ever public library, which was built in Scotland in Leadhills, which is this tiny mining town. And it was built.
The name.
I know. Yeah, and built by Scottish miners who didn't own the houses they lived in, didn't own the land they worked on. But together they managed to build this library. And it was the first ever public one. And it was incredible when we went there to think that all these people who had such poor existence managed to self-educate their children and kind of give them hope. And then as we went through these libraries, the amount of students we saw studying, because you think of London as somewhere which is, you know, super privileged and I guess has lots of opportunities. The flip side of that is that there's so many people who don't have their own room, can't afford to have a laptop, can't afford to have Wi-Fi. You know, I think we went to one library and there was just queues for seats. And I don't know, I think I was actually shocked myself, realising how important these spaces are, not just for mothers. And I mean, I don't know, it's just for students to study.
You mentioned in passing your year on Harry Potter, and you've also talked about, you know, attending state school and everything. So I wondered what that experience was like, you know, finding yourself on a film set for a year at 13 years old. I mean, that's quite a shocker, really.
No, it is. No, I was always obsessed with uniform because I never had one. I went to a local school in Hampstead and then the one in Camden. And, we just got to wear what we wanted, which is most people's dream. But for me, I don't know, I'd see all these students on the bus and they'd all just look, I don't know, I was obsessed with uniforms. And I just remember turning up on my first day and the wardrobe assistant was like, this is what you're going to be wearing, blah, blah, blah. I was just so happy about putting on a tie. I mean, waking up in the morning, I think I had to wake up every day for a year at like 5 o'clock, getting on a train and then getting on a coach to Leeson Studios. I was just so excited about just getting there and then changing out of my normal clothes and putting on this uniform. It was just endlessly thrilling every morning. And most people would be like, oh, God, I've just, you know, to wake up at the crack of dawn and I'd be like, how do I do this tie?
And did you manage to create a uniform for yourself after you finished the filming? Because it must have been quite traumatic to be separated from your costume.
It was really traumatic. I kind of had to be eased into society. No, I learnt the good life skill of doing a tie, which I probably, I don't know.
We'll never use again.
We'll never use again.
And was it quite difficult re-assimilating after you spent this year out and in uniform to return to the casual dress of your school friends and their normal lives?
Well, it was, I don't know. We did 3 hours of tutoring a day. So I was kind of always, and when I got back to school, I was about to sit my GCSEs. So I basically missed the last year before you sit your GCSEs. So it was all a bit chaotic. But I've always been that sort of person who loved doing a million things. I don't know, I kind of have always sought out other worlds to kind of make me feel that I could do other things. I don't know, it was always a bit of a mad mix.
You said, I'm not a single mother, which you're not. But you do have two children.
Yeah.
And still seemingly, to many of us who are very old, a child yourself, virtually. And I know it's not a question that would normally be asked of male poets or indeed many men generally, but Cyril Connolly did write, you know, the whole thing about the pram and the hall being the enemy of creativity. Mm. And I know that you found it to be completely the opposite, which I have to say was also my experience. Yeah. I had my children very late. Yeah. You had yours very early.
Yeah.
But it does, for me, it just gave me a sense of purpose. You know, now my working hours are really, really sort of sacrosanct. And, you know, I think I put a lot into them.
Yeah.
Tell me about your experience.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think there's definitely like a myth that we somehow, I don't know, become just totally consumed by this child, which you do, but I felt that, especially as a poet, as a writer, I guess, that I'd felt every emotion, that I'd written about it, which is totally not true. As soon as it's a total lie. I mean, as soon as you have a child, you're like, God, I didn't realize I could feel this much worry or this much love or pain or whatever, which I find really inspiring. And I think it's also, it opens you up to a whole new world of other women and stories and things you just you weren't aware of, because why would you be without a child? I mean, making this film, the reason why, you know, we wanted her to be a single mother, but we didn't want it to be her downfall. We didn't want it to be the thing. Usually when you watch indie cinema, a lot of it is a depressing portrait of a mother. And I think we wanted to show a kind of modern version of a woman who, you know, did all these different things. And yeah, she happened to be a mother too. And it was stressful and it's hard work. But yeah, I was just amazed by just things you'd never discuss until you become a mother. And I'm sure you've had many conversations about this too.
Wait till you have menopause.
Yeah, I mean, that's, see, and it's stuff like this, which we just don't talk about. And it just seems crazy. So yeah, I find it fascinating. But I do think there's definitely a shift. And I think, I don't know, I've seen lots of women and communities come together and I find it really inspiring in that sense. But I guess, yeah.
I'm going to ask you about your luxury. Mm. And I'm wondering if it's a mini break away from your two young children. But maybe not. I think you've brought something that you consider to be your luxury. I mean, do you think about luxury? Your life, is it luxurious? What is your luxury?
For me, I think luxury is being able to make mistakes and being creative. For instance, making feature film, doing that, for me, I feel incredibly honoured and feel like that is a luxury, to be able to develop an idea and make it happen. Increasingly more now, the idea of idleness is kind of something I never thought about until maybe becoming a mother. I personally need to feel this sort of state of just wasting time in order to feel renewed and to get ideas and to daydream and to feel alive. I guess that's probably a reason why I feel like I need to leave the house every day, is that I think it's just, yeah, wasting time. It just feels, I think, to me, that's a kind of a great luxury.
It's not something you can bring.
No, it's true. I brought a book. I brought a Sharon Olds book because I also feel like luxury is, I find luxury is reading as well.
And so why have you picked Sharon Olds?
I've picked her because I've only recently discovered her and I've kind of read lots of things about her. And the collection is called Stag's Leap, and it's just so incredibly moving and brave, and it's about her leaving her husband, and it was just like chapters of her life, and it was just incredibly complex and real. So yeah, I think luxury in sort of being able to just read and dip in and out of people's minds on the page.
So would your luxury be to sit down with that Sharon Olds book and read it cover to cover, or to just have 5 minutes here and there where you can read another passage?
I guess, well, both, but to read it from back to front, locking myself in the bathroom and reading is what I increasingly do these days. I mean, yeah, or like, yeah, reading in the bath, that's just the height of luxury for me.
Oh, the glamour.
I know.
So if I was to let you roam round Harrods in a particular department, maybe you should go to the sort of interiors, brand new interiors bit that's opening, because there you could probably find a very large bath that you could wallow in for days.
Maybe that's where my poet in residence spot should be. Just have an endless pruned woman in the bath reading.
I think that we could probably attract quite a lot. I think there's a lot of customers that might be attracted by the idea of a beautiful young blonde woman lying in the bath reading poems about sex.
Like, I'd be the Harrods Santa.
Harrods Naughty Santa.
Naughty Santa. I have to have a few sort of like bathroom elves. I don't know. You get a better poem at the end of it.
You're taking this way too far now. You know that, don't you?
Get me out. That's terrible.
Thank you so much, Greta.
No, thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup, and my guest, Greta Bella Machina. Next week, I'm with Amy Powney, the creative director of Mother of Pearl, talking about fashion and sustainability and growing up off-grid. This series is recorded in Harrods in London. This season of True Tales of Luxury is proudly sponsored by Visa. Visa, everywhere you want to be.